This is the BAMA Podcast with Marty Solomon. I'm his co-host, Brent Billings. Today, I am with Reed Dent and Josh Busse, again for the second week in a row, to discuss Psalm 23 this time.
Indeed. Psalm 23. And this time, I'm in charge.
I was just going to say, I really think you're with Josh Busse and Reed Dent. It's the other way, Brent, because Josh is taking the helm on Psalm 23.
Mm-hmm.
It's a seniority thing. You came on the podcast first, Reed, and then L, and then Josh. So...
okay.
Josh is the low man on the totem pole. There's nothing I can do about it.
All right. That's fair.
Wow. You're the high man. You're the high man in my book always, Josh. Don't let Brent say that to you.
Well, thank you. I'll wear that with a smile on my face as a badge of honor.
All I am is 40. That's all I am.
Well, 40. Speaking of numbers, once again, we have a pretty short psalm on our hands. 6 verses. Psalm 23, you may have heard of this one before.
So short episode is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, short episode. Probably about as short as our one last week.
You're guaranteeing it.
Yeah, we couldn't possibly stumble on anything too interesting. I mean, don't we already know what's in this psalm? We know what's here. What new treasures could be mined from this psalm? And actually, let's start there. What do all of you think of this psalm? Like, it's the psalm everyone knows. Like, it's in movies. It's penetrated popular culture. This is a very well known psalm. What does it conjure for you guys experientially?
I remember hearing about when my grandpa died. I know this is not necessarily how you expected this to begin, but he had a minister come visit him because he felt like he was close, and this is what he wanted read to him, which was very strange for me because as I grew up, I had never saw him engage in religion or the Bible or anything. And so I was like, oh, that, and sure, like, it is a popular psalm, but meaningful enough for him to make that a priority at the end of his life.
Yeah.
This is a great psalm for that occasion, I think. So my first thought is like, this is the precious moment psalm. but more seriously, I think of, I remember being in English classes, like in college, and we would have anthologies of poetry and different kinds of anthologies. And this showed up in one of those anthologies. And I think of it then as like, recognized, loved poetry. Like, it's not just a loved Bible verse or chapter, but it's something that's recognized as kind of like having an all-time place in the literature of the world. And I think for good reason. Like, it's very, very beautiful, and it is very memorizable. We actually, that's another memory that I have, is memorizing this with my kids, like when they were younger. And there's a lyrical kind of sing-songy quality to the way that, depending on the translation that you use. I just think of it as great poetry. I feel it is about being comforted, and it sounds and feels comforting to say, is my experience with it.
Yeah, I think that's I think a lot of people will relate to that. And I remember for me when I first heard John Foreman's rendition of this, like that idea of being in the house of God forever, like that always really moved me. There is this, deep sense of comfort. And it is really beautiful. It is a pillar of global literature, not just a piece of inspired text. Not that that makes it higher or more valuable, but it is part of the context of how we arrive at Psalm 23. And, you know, on Bema, we often, you know, we've talked about the lullaby effect. And like you said, Reed, like for a lot of people, like this operates as poetry primarily, like especially when it's got these familiar rhythms and it has this very like palpable sense of place of the images are just abundant and overflowing, and they really pull us along, pull us through it. And that's not a bad thing by any stretch. But for our purposes today, I would really like us to try and hear this with fresh ears.
Oh man, speaking of fresh ears, I went to the Wikipedia page because I was thinking like, this is the kind of thing where people want to depict it in art and have these visual ideas of what it is. And I was thinking I might find a few examples of that, which there are a couple. But what I'm actually seeing more so is just how many times this psalm has been adapted into song and not just like a literal, like putting music to the words of the psalm, but whatever. Yeah. Like, wow.
Yeah.
I imagine there's probably some fresh ear perspectives if we go back to all of some of these options.
Yeah, definitely. That would be a really interesting project. That would be a cool companion to this episode if the listeners out there want to do their own little project, as you know, listen to a variety of how other people have interpreted this. That would be I'm sure it would render some really interesting insights.
I'll put the link in the show notes. But how, Josh, are we going to hear it with fresh ears right now?
Well, we're going to do two things. First of all, I'm going to have Brent read from the Robert Alter translation, both because Robert Alter's translation is great. I love it in general, but specifically because one of the pieces of his agenda is to maintain the literary qualities, and he's especially good with that, in my opinion, with the poetic books. His translation of Job is fantastic. And Psalms, same thing. So I think that his passion for keeping that artistic quality of the text vibrant is really apparent, and perhaps hearing some different words and hearing some different takes on how to make the meter line up and the way he understands Hebrew poetic verse in a very academic way as well. So it's, I think, very faithful. But the other thing I'm going to do is kind of like what we do when we normally want to do something fresh is give ourselves a little space, a little break. So real quick, I'm gonna have us do a short little meditation. Just sit with our breath, you know, wherever you are. If you're sitting, be aware of how your weight is pressing down against the world around you, against the chair beneath you, the couch you're sitting on, the car seat you're driving in, the shoes you're standing on, the way you're walking. Just take a breath. I wish we could keep on doing that for a while, but we're going to do a short episode today. I feel it in my bones. So,
even with the breathing.
So I will now invite Mr. Brent Billings to take us into the text.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. In grass meadows he makes me lie down. By quiet waters guides me. My life he brings back. He leads me on pathways of justice for his name's sake. Though I walk in the veil of death's shadow, I fear no harm, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, it is they that console me. You set out a table before me in the face of my foes. You moisten my head with oil, my cup overflows. Let but goodness and kindness pursue me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for many long days.
That was well read, Brent. Thank you for that. There's a couple things that Alter actually points out in his notes that I want to highlight. Which is first that we have a pretty distinct shift in this psalm about halfway through. The front half we see the author speaking about God in the third person, right? The Lord is my shepherd. And then we switch to seeing the author talking directly to God. You set a table before me. And that's going to be important as we look at the structure of the psalm and everything. So we have three verses talking about God in the third person, three verses speaking to God in the second person. And there's also an accompanying shift in imagery from this idea of, you know, the life of a sheep with this wonderful shepherd to the life of a person serving this good God. And in both cases, like we talked about earlier, they're very comforting. They're talking about God's provision and care, even when we go through difficult times, and the constancy of God's presence. And more specifically, I see in there an important jump in imagery between the author being metaphorically cast as a sheep and the author just as a human being, you know, living their life, having enemies, needing to be cared for, all that stuff. So with all that being laid out, first of all, what are y'all hearing? Just broad, open, subjective question. Did anything new pop out?
It strikes me when you mentioned the shift in imagery, that was tracking along with something that kind of happened with me where sort of feeling a little, I don't know if the word is like disjointed, but in terms of like sense of place, like I feel like the opening part has a very strong sense of place because we're having all of these kind of features of the landscape described to us. Mm-hmm. You've got the green pastures or the meadows, as Alter calls it. You've got the waters. You've got the valley of the shadow of death. And then suddenly when the table shows up, I get this, like, I don't know where I am now. And I think that's also like this accompanying, I was a sheep and now I'm not a sheep anymore. Mm-hmm. But like, where is this table being set? You know, if I'm even supposed to be thinking about such a thing, but it seems a little weird. Like I just, a dinner table is like plopped down in the middle of like a meadow somewhere, or am I now meant to, there's this anointing, right?
Yes.
The head with the oil. And so it feels like our place should have shifted, but I don't exactly know what to picture there, where the first half has very, very strong, like I have an actual place in Northeast Missouri that is just like this that's being described, and I can put myself there.
That's some good stuff. But before I comment on that, Brent, what about you?
Well, I also thought about that table idea, and I was picturing like this wide open meadow. And he's just sitting there with a table covered in all of the stuff for a feast. And he's just sitting back, sipping his cup that's overflowing. And then you hear this low rumble and this army like comes over over the top of the hill. And he's just sitting there enjoying, I don't know, whatever.
That's a fun image.
Yeah. The thing that stuck out to me the most was your rod and your staff. And normally it's your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And I've always thought of that as like, oh, I see your rod and your staff and I'm comforted by the idea that you're in control and you're going to protect me and blah, blah, blah. But the way it's phrased here, your rod and your staff, it is they that console me. It makes it seem like the rod and the staff are active agents in this action rather than just me like perceiving something.
Ooh.
And I don't know if there's anything to that, but like I just that just made me flip my perspective a little bit on that.
I like that. I like that. I think there's probably a lot of directions we could go with that. I'm interested to see if that comes back up because that those lines will actually prove to be pretty important as we dive deeper into this. But yeah, I want to. It's interesting that both of you had the exact same vision of, you know, being in this wide open meadow and having, you know, a table, you know, descending from heaven and, you know, all this nice stuff being poured on the, I don't know. I think a lot of times we imagine this as being King David. So we can just go with that image without being too pedantic about it. But yeah, you know, King David just chilling in the in this grassy meadow with all these nice things. One thing Alter mentions here that I thought was really interesting, because I had, you know, made some assumptions in the text, is he talks about the use of oil here. Like, apparently the terminology in Hebrew is not anointing. It's more of this kind of luxurious, like he's conditioned his hair, like he's just moisturized, you know, he's feeling good.
Okay.
From his mm-hmm. body to this, you know, table set in front of him to this, you know, never ending cup. And it is interesting the way we aren't given the same kind of description of setting as we are in the first half, but it is more of like a social setting. He is blessed even in the face of enemies. He has a full table. His cup is overflowing. He's moisturized. He's feeling good. And that kind of flows from the idea of walking in the valley, the veil of death's shadow, as Alter put it. And yeah, it is interesting that there becomes a little bit more vagary in the scene that we're supposed to be imagining. And we should also take it with a grain of salt, because this is pretty standard for biblical language. We don't usually get like descriptions of settings like we do in, you know, modern stories and novels and such. They talk about dialogue and characters and what they do, not usually like what color the curtains were or how the light was hitting Abraham's face or anything like that. So that's not entirely unusual, but it is interesting. And it looks like you were about to say something, Reed. What have you got?
Well, are we going to talk about the enemies? Because I wonder, well, we can maybe save this for that, but my question is, like, what is the relationship between psalmist and enemies in the kind of dream imagery that's, like, going on in this psalm, you know? Because it almost is like a dream. Mm-hmm. And is it, like, I think the knee-jerk reaction is to hear it's adversarial, but there is this almost like this force field of like untouchability, like I'm going to eat in peace and you might be standing there, but you can't do anything to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there like, is it possible to hear it as there is even a sense of like peace between psalmist and enemies?
This is a good question. So, and actually, I think it's more of the first image. If I had to take a stand based on the Hebrew, because it, mm-hmm. it uses the word in the presence of to talk about the table being in the psalmist's presence. You prepared a table before me.
Okay.
But then when it says in the presence of my enemies, it doesn't use the same word of like in their presence. It uses the word neged, which we might remember all the way back in Genesis 2, the etzer kenegdo. Neged being that which is opposite or opposed.
Oh, yeah.
So there
yeah,
is
yeah.
this idea of there being a table here and the author eating at it, and there are enemies present and they're opposed. But you could read that image a lot of different ways. Is there this force field where, like Brent's image, there's this army, you know, cresting the grassy hill, and our boys just sitting there munching and sipping and, you know, knows God's got his back? Or are they sitting across the table from him? Like, there's a lot of, and this is where I think
yeah.
your point about like, okay, wait, what's the image here? That is, I think, really important.
Well, and even thinking about, this is good. I think I'm hearing this in a fresh way now, just like you wanted from the beginning, Josh. The idea of the enemy sitting across the table from him. What's interesting is like, so there's opposition, but the way in which these enemies are being overcome is not like in a violent way.
Yes.
Right. They're not being cast down by a sword, or any other such thing. It is a meal, and the meal is like, here's our central, like, kind of combat strategy against these enemies is we're going to sit down and eat, and somehow we are protected in our eating. And that represents like an overthrow of the power of the enemy. And I just think that's a really fascinating way to think about it. And of course, then my Christian brain starts thinking about like Eucharist and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, that's I'm really glad your head's going in that direction. And in fact, I want to point out one other element that kind of vibes with that. And that's, I really like how Alter translated in verse 4. Instead of saying, I will fear no evil, he put, I will fear no harm. And this, I think, oh man, I could do a whole episode just on this, because a lot of times when we think of evil, we talk about it exclusively as a moral category, which the Bible definitely covers that. But there are a lot of cases where, like, the word for evil in Hebrew, I'm not going to get into a whole Hebrew lesson, but a lot of times it's used in ways that are clearly not moral. Like, to put it bluntly, it talks about God doing evil in that sense. And so it very clearly is not just a moral category, but it's more a category of something that does harm. And I think that goes along with it. Like, there isn't this kind of triumphalism of like, you know, oh yeah, I don't fear these evildoers because God's going to judge them. He's like, you know, I'm not afraid of getting hurt. And now I'm at a table and my enemies are there. And you're right. It is a bit of a dreamlike image. Like, you know, oh, I'm back at high school and all my bullies are around me, but I'm okay with that for some reason. What's going on? I love that.
Yeah.
Really quick, I want to anchor us before we get too in the weeds, because we do have a time limit here, folks. We are doing a short episode, just to let you all know.
if you say it enough, then yeah. You'll start to believe it.
yes. Orientation, disorientation, new orientation. What are we hearing here?
So, I mean, I definitely hear orientation in the beginning. The lying down in the pastures and the sitting beside the waters, that feels oriented. When you get to the valley of the shadow of death, and sorry, I do want to say, like, Alter is beyond me in every single way, but in the veil of death's shadow is not my favorite translation.
That's fine.
And I see his note there. I'm actually looking at it too on why he chose that, and that's fine. But I think the valley of the shadow of death is just such a beautiful stringing together of syllables. So I'm going to go with that.
It has a rhythm to it.
Yeah. So when you get to the valley of the shadow of death and not fearing harm there, that feels like a little bit more, I guess, within those categories, kind of new orientation-ish. There is a present danger, but I am not afraid of it. And then even like the what we've already talked about with the sort of victory over the enemies, the presence, or the table there and the anointing in the presence of the enemies also feels like a new orientation kind of thing. Like, yes, there is a present danger, but I'm not going to fear it. So I guess there's kind of a mixture here is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I concur. What about you, Brent? Do you have a thought on that?
I think I see more new orientation, even in the first part, because it says, my life he brings back.
That's true. That's true.
He has this new, like, yes, he has this perspective that seems oriented, but it also seems like that he's come out of some other experience.
Right.
He's been brought back to life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Alter's note there says, the image is of someone who has almost stopped breathing and is revived, brought back to life. So yeah, it's like and that tracks with then the idea of being in the valley of the shadow of death. Like you're on death's door, you're almost there, and then your life is restored to you.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. I hear both of those things. Yeah. I think that the more we look into it, yeah, like, yeah, there's orientation in all of it. God's my shepherd. I'm living in that. But then there's also seems to be hints at a new orientation, and it seems to have kind of vaulted over the disorientation. Like, and I'm glad that I'm not crazy, because when I was looking at this, I was like, I don't see any disorientation at all. But I will say this, I think there is an element of disorientation, but it isn't in the psalmist's point of view. I think it's in our point of view when we I don't know. Maybe there's something deeper going on here. I've hinted at this a little bit, but we you smell that, Brent? Is that, what could that be?
No. No. You smell it? That's Marty's line, Josh.
That is Marty's line. I've got to come up with my
No, but I love you stealing it. No, take it. Take it for your own.
No, I've come up with my own line. This is trademarked to Josh. Brent, it's time to huff this chiasm. We're just going to we're going to breathe in deep. But yes, there's a
Is this, I mean,
if that's what you want to put your trademark on, sure.
I didn't think you were.
Why not?
I didn't think you. I saw it in the notes. I didn't think you were actually going to say it. Does this have like really strong drug connotations with huffing? Like when I think of huffing, I'm like thinking about huffing, you know, like Sharpies and spray paint cans and stuff like that. Am I crazy? Is huff just a word for smell?
I think it has those connotations, but I would like to be intoxicated with God's spirit and the text. I think that's wow. Fine to say.
Look at you. Yes, absolutely. I love the leaps forward. Like you're taking Marty walked so that you could run, Josh.
Well, yeah, like you said, I'm the new guy here, so I gotta stand out.
That's right.
But no, there is a chiasm here. I kind of alluded to it earlier, where you know we have three verses that talk about God this way, three verses that talk to God this way, three verses of this image, three verses of that image. But if we look closer, where we might expect to see some parallels. You know, if we look at the bookends, what do we have in the first verse? We have the Lord is my shepherd. At the end of the last verse, I will dwell in the house of the Lord. Only two times in this psalm where it uses the tetragrammaton, yod, hey, vav, hey. And in both, it's talking about our relationship with God. And in both, a pretty intimate relationship. There's this shepherd image. And it specifically references the not needing anything, being taken care of. And in the end, we have this idea of also like being taken care of, being pursued by goodness and kindness, dwelling in the house of the Lord, almost like a bait of kind of relationship with God. A familial thing.
I was going to say they're both communal. I mean, because as a sheep, if you're in a flock, right? You're not the only sheep.
Yeah.
So shepherd automatically like is denoting a group, and then in the bait, the house, there is a whole bunch of other people from the family who are also there. So I like that too.
All right. Now let's see if we see other similarities here. If we look at verse 2, we have these lush images, lying down in grass meadows, being guided by quiet waters. And in verse 5, oh, what's this? We have an image of a table being spread out. We have food, and then we have an overflowing cup, drink. And not only that, you two both associated the table with the meadow. Isn't that interesting?
You tricked us, psalmist.
But yeah, in both, like, there's this luxurious tone, like, not just God is providing, but like, you know, Marty's talked about before, like, in realistic terms, the sheep are not getting a lush green meadow. They're, you know, eating dry grass and whatnot. But the psalmist chooses to use luxurious images, like, you know, mm-hmm. like screensaver background images. Mm-hmm. And the same goes with this idea of an overflowing cup. Like, that's David. And no one probably has ever had really a cup that always overflows. Like, that's a poetic image, right? It's a luxurious exaggeration.
I love the word luxurious. I think that's a great word to describe what's going on here. The cup, too, tracks with the waters. And I think cup by itself might be more of a stretch, but the fact that it is an overflowing cup, like you are invited to see like whatever liquid is being poured into overflowing and sitting by the waters, I like that connection.
Or some sort of miraculous situation where the cup itself is a spring of whatever you imagine it being filled with, wine or water or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, like striking the rock.
Ah, yeah.
The wine's just pouring out of this cup. Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, We only have two verses left. This is a short psalm, and it's a short episode.
This is going to be a short episode.
This is going to be a short episode, I promise. Okay, so we're getting really close to the center of this chiasm. And what do we have? As was mentioned earlier, specifically, you mentioned, Brent, the kind of parallel between being brought back into life and this parallel of walking through the shadow of death, like these two moments of briefly like kind of a flirtation with danger, brushing up against something dangerous, but being taken care of by God. And not only this, if you have the pleasure of reading this in Alter's translation, where he does a good job of like lining out the different verses, like the poetic verses, you'll see that verse 3 and verse 4 both have the only triple verses in the whole poem. We have the triple verse, my life he brings back, he leads me on the pathways of justice for his name's sake. Those are three distinct verses. And we have the same thing in verse 4. I walk through the veil of death's shadow, I fear no harm, for you are with me. Three statements. So there's a lot of parallels there. So there's this turning point between these two, and I think now we can see it quite clearly. But there's also a shift between these two, as is normal with a chiasm. One of them is that if you're looking at it, all the verses in the second half are much, much longer. In fact, they all have an extra doublet, a little two-line verse at the end. So in verse 4, we have the three-part line, the mm-hmm. three-part verse, and mm-hmm. then a little two verse. And then verse 5, we have a double verse followed by another double verse. And then 6, double with a double. So in all those ways, it parallels, but there's an addition of something else. And it's really interesting. Now, the one thing that I want to bring in, and actually, Brent, you really set this up beautifully. So did you, Reed. The question is like, what's being buried here? What is hidden underneath this chiasm? We can see these parallels. Aren't they just saying the same thing? And this is where, if we're going to guess, like the person who wrote this chiasm intentionally, where would you say they're putting the weight of the hint of like, there's something extra in here? Where would you say that would be between these two halves?
Well, verse 4 is just, there's more text.
And I would say in general, the second half is the one where there's these additional doublets, additional little double lines. So there's something that happens between the first half and the second half, something that transforms it right in the center there that changes everything. And I think this is part of why we detected more of a new orientation in the second half than in the first half, even though we can see evidence of both orientation and new orientation in both halves. Something changes where the second half that becomes really apparent. Now, we skirted over something. Remember how I talked earlier about how the images shift from being a sheep to being not a sheep, being a person? That's almost true, except look at the very first doublet, the very first additional doublet in the second half. After you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you're comforted by the rod and the staff. Wait a second, that's still sheep imagery.
On the staff of the shepherd.
It's still sheep imagery.
Right.
So now, here's what I would invite us to do. Let's consider if maybe there is no shift in imagery. Maybe it's a sheep the whole way through. So now let's start from the outside in, from the bookmark or the bookend. So a sheep is dwelling in the house of the Lord for many long days. That's interesting. Are there any sheep in God's house? What is God's house, by the way? We were talking about this. What's the setting of this last half? We kind of couldn't figure it out before.
Well, if this is David, then it would be the temple, right?
Okay, this might be the temple or the Mishkan or
right.
Whatever. This is God's house, literally. This is the temple. And are there sheep in God's temple?
For sacrifices.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So yeah, there's sheep there for sacrifices. That's weird.
Do they keep them there?
That's weird. I don't know. I couldn't speak authoritatively on that.
I guess it would be Solomon's temple, not David's temple. So maybe not the temple, but either way.
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to be nitpicky about it. But God, we know what God's house is.
We're here for nitpicky, though, Josh. So.
No, I mean, not this time.
We don't
time.
Have time because it's going to be a short episode.
That's true. It's a short nitpick. Episode. We don't got time for it. So we have a sheep in God's house. Okay, let's go back one before. A table set out and an overflowing cup. What does this remind us of in the temple with sheep?
I mean, the altar.
The altar, yeah, that looks like a table. And being moistened with oil, did they put oil on sacrifices?
I'm going to say yes.
And where would you have an overflowing cup? Where might this image come up? What did they collect in a cup?
The blood.
Blood, yes. So then if we peel it back to the center, a sheep walking through the valley of death's shadow, not being afraid because its shepherd is still with it, consoling it, guiding it with the rod and the staff. And then the sheep sees a table, an altar. And across from the sheep is the sheep's foes, or the psalmist's foes. And the sheep is anointed with oil, moistened with oil. Its throat is slit. Its blood is pouring out, so much so that it overflows the basin. And we get to the, let goodness and kindness pursue me. That's a really, how is this goodness and kindness for the sheep? Something that's really interesting in the Hebrew here is that word for pursue is most often used to talk about someone pursuing someone else violently with the intent to harm them. So it's a bit of a predatory hunting type of image. So goodness is seeking the life of this lamb all the days of its life that it has left. And it dwells in the house of the Lord for many long days. I think the picture that is being painted here is the psalmist imagining this relationship of shepherd and sheep and saying, yeah, but you know what? Sometimes shepherds sacrifice their sheep, right? Like that happens. That's where the sheep come from. The shepherds raise them and then some of them are slaughtered. And why are they slaughtered? They're slaughtered to, as you put so beautifully before, Reed, to overcome the power of evil, to eradicate foes by making them no longer our foes.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so in your imagination here, Josh, what if we're imagining a sheep being led to the altar for slaughter, for sacrifice? Talk to me about foes in that setting. Can you say a bit more about how you're interpreting that?
Let me put it this way. If I'm the psalmist, I'll start from the beginning. If I'm the psalmist, I'm talking, we talked earlier about how there's so much, you know, trust in this image, like a sheep trusting a shepherd. You take care of all my needs and you do so luxuriously. You've brought me back to life. I was stuck. I was sick and you nursed me back to health. But now you're bringing me into this scary place. I'm there's things on both sides of me. There's walls around me. I'm used to being out in the field, but now I'm in this place. It's like a valley and it smells weird. And I'm maybe even hearing other animals crying out. And I can sense that death is nearby, but I am not afraid because you are still with me. You didn't, you know, leave me at in a stranger's care. You're still with me. And if we think about this as, you know, the author isn't exploring what it genuinely is like to be a sheep, but what it is like to follow God, this is where I think the foes thing comes back. This person trusts not just in God in a personal relationship of you take care of me, therefore I trust you and I'm a sheep. They're saying, you know, you've more than proved yourself to me. You've been luxuriously abundant to me, more abundant in your love for me, God, than is even really reasonably possible in this life. And you've proven that love for me again and again. So if I have to sacrifice so that even my enemies can be saved, if I'm brought as the sacrificial lamb, not to save my friend, but to save my enemy, I still trust in you. I don't feel like I'm being pursued and hunted down and killed because of my enemy's sin. I look at that situation and see it's your goodness and your kindness that is after my life so that these foes can be reconciled at the same table. That's a new orientation right there. And in realizing that the sheep never went away, that it's a sheep all the way through, we're disoriented a little bit. Like, that was our experience just going through this. Wait, what are the foes doing here? Wait, what? Okay, in the temple, I guess. Wait, am I the sacrifice? What the heck? I thought this was a overflowing cup of my beverage of choice. I thought I was getting a nice, you know, oil scalp massage.
And waxing poetically, thinking about the final line there. I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for many long days. But like what you're saying is like, well, not that many long days because you're about to be sacrificed. But then it like elevates our understanding of what it means to dwell in the house of the Lord. And maybe that's not strictly like, well, I like, you know, I had my beverage of choice and subsisted on this particular bread inside this building for this number of like calendar days. But that dwelling in the house of the Lord, there is a sense like when you read it this way, that it means more than like it transcends the boundaries of like, you know, if the sheep is sacrificed, you know, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And to speak to that poetically, there's a couple things. I mean, the sacrifice, there's two things that the sacrifice kind of transforms into. And the first is that it becomes smoke, which goes up into God's presence. That's what the text says. And it's a pleasing aroma, or it could also be read as a spirit of rest to God. So that in that sense, he could be looking at it as like, I am before you. And that in a qualitative sense, that's a wonderful long day. That's that day that, you know, we all think about from high school where we had that, you know, really cool spontaneous trip or whatever. And we made a lot of deep friendships.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the other thing. Cause it is interesting that you bring up like, well, not many long days. And it is interesting because in the Hebrew, it does say for lengthy days is like a literal translation, but it does use days plural, which you could say, well, Josh, that your reading doesn't work. This is all in your head. But here's the thing. In the Torah, when you bring an animal sacrifice that is for peace, you have to share it with other people because you have to eat it all in one place. You can't take it home with you. You have to eat a whole animal. And, you know, even a sheep isn't that big, but still, like, I mean, you couldn't eat all that in a sitting, maybe not even your family. So what's happening in the courtyard is that there are feasts going on. And especially when I read Torah with a Jesus-y lens, I see God nudging people to say, hey, you came here to bring a peace offering because life is good for you and God's been good to you. And there's someone else here who brought a sacrifice that they can't eat because they're repenting. They're dealing with sin. They're going through a rough spot in life. You have extra food. They just got to smell meat cooking, but don't have any food to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you two get together and have a feast and reconcile and build new bonds in this beautiful moment of worship and repentance and celebration? And I wonder if the psalmist is looking at that and saying, that's my life. My life is the feast that my life purchased, that my death purchased, rather. That is still the continuation of my life. And those are beautiful, long days of feasting and redemption. And that doesn't challenge this person's faith in God. And in fact, that's what I think is so incredible about this, is how seamless and how ephemeral this transition is. Like we talked about it at a couple points, we talked about it being dreamlike, the way it kind of just flows into like, oh wait, now we're here. Now we're, you know, a human and we're getting all these things, these beautiful images, this abundance. And that sense of palpable abundance is still there. But what if that abundance is coming at our cost? What if that abundance is sacrificial love? Again, not just for our friends, but for our enemies. Like, if we don't hear Jesus in that, if we don't hear loving your enemies and look at this and say, what if we weren't just like willing to love our enemies, but we saw that as an extension of God's bounty to us,
right?
That our lives, even in moments of great sacrifice, personal sacrifice, what if our trust in God was so deep that we didn't experience any disruption in our relationship with God? We looked at that and saw, oh yeah, this is just a continuation of the fields. This is a continuation of the meadows and the brooks, and you nursing me back to health, leading me on those pathways of righteousness. And that's where when I go to the center, I see this idea of God saving our lives. What was the reason why God saved our lives in that? And why did God save the sheep's life in verse 3?
To be led on pathways of justice for his name's sake.
For his name's sake. And there was a little weird thing in the Hebrew that I won't get into, but I talked to you guys about it before the episode. And I think it's meant to blur the lines there of, is it my life? Is it God's life? Like, I am so close to God. God is the reason I'm alive. And God's love for me is part of his identity. It's part of his name. It's at the very root of his being. This isn't some side thing. This is God's thing. And when we really get caught up in that, when we trust in that enough, that starts to grow into us and become our identity, it doesn't become a dramatic shift towards, oh, now my life's hard. Now I'm having to sacrifice. It's the same flow of God saved my life because he loves me, and now I get to sacrifice to save someone else's life, to redeem them.
Yeah, and the restoration that is, I think, continuous. Like, he brings my life back. Like we talked about Alter's footnote there, you know, the image being of you've almost stopped breathing. And it's like to the point that the giving of myself for the sake of my enemies, like that depletes me, you know, to some point. And yes, this like I relate to this because the work of this kind of sacrificial love is very difficult. Like, it's not just easy, you know, and it does take something from you. And yet, when you walk in the path of justice for your enemies, not the retributive justice, right, but we want to restore them, then, like, however much that takes from you, there is this image, this recurring image of the life is brought back. Like, I'm brought back again, and I'm brought back again. Yeah, and that just the overflowing cup too. You get the sense of like whatever in us is being poured out into this cup or from this cup that is overflowing, it can keep doing that. God can keep restoring that so that it can keep being overflowed. And then I'm also just thinking of the stream, you know, and the stream has no beginning or end. It just kind of keeps flowing on. Yeah, that's really incredible.
And that's where we see in the center this blurring, even as the sheep is, you know, going up. And, you know, at this point, if it is a sacrifice, it's not with its shepherd anymore. It would be the person who's, you know, doing the sacrifice for themselves.
Right.
But still the sheep says, "You're with me." And in the same way that like their identity as a sheep is blurred with the shepherd and our identity is blurred into God's, so too, like exactly what you were just saying, this like, well, the sheep dies, but like you said, there's the cup is overflowing. It's almost like there is no end to our capacity to bring redemption. And even after this, you know, sacrificial death of a kind, and I hope everyone understands that I'm not suggesting, you know, to do anything that harms yourself in a physical way, but to see that is not the end of your life, but the continuation of and the deepening of and the broadening of your life, especially when we consider how our life is bound up in God and God's kingdom. And there is no distinction between those things in this view of the psalmist. And
it's got some real resurrection vibes there, Josh.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I think about, you know, if we share in a death like his, how much more will we share in a life like his? I think about we carry around his death in our bodies all day long, you know, and I mean, that'd preach for sure.
Oh, man. I love that.
Man, this is pretty incredible. I'm now, Josh, officially thinking about this psalm in a very new way. This is all shifted. Nice. Mission accomplished.
New orientation, baby. Oh, that's lovely. Brent, how about you?
Even the idea of, like, in the face of my enemies, like, I think I've always just thought of David, like, on the run, in battle, under attack. And then the idea of, like, oh, not only could he just be sitting at a table face to face with his enemies, but that table is an altar of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't, like, that's part of my question too, is like, what is the setting when this sacrifice is being made? Are the enemies, would the enemies ever feasibly be there for the sacrifice, witnessing this? So many questions remain, but absolutely seeing this in a whole new light. So thank you.
I think it is so interesting to think, I imagine this now as a psalm that David wrote late in his life, because I think about the way that enemies are dealt with throughout the psalms, and it's not uniform. It is not always this sense of, like, the giving of oneself for the sake of an enemy. I mean, you have, actually, Elle and I are going to be recording soon on Psalm 137, which is much more of a collective communal psalm, speaking with the we voice, but it's about, that's the one that infamously ends with, "Happy are they who take the children and dash them against the rocks," you know, and and we're going to talk about the function and the place that has and why it's important to be able to say those kinds of things. And I don't know if David wrote that psalm or not, who knows? But even in other ones, like, I'm thinking about Psalm 139, that is about being knit together in the mother's womb. But then there's this aside where it talks about, "Oh God, that you would slay the wicked." And there is this cry out, you know, and I don't know. I like to think in my dreamlike imagination that David, whose life in a lot of ways is marked by enemies, right? The enemies that he fought and that pursued him, that after a life of going through all of these enemy relationships and then looking back on it and reflecting, that even as he himself maybe approaches the valley of the shadow of death, his own death, he sees something deeper in all of this, that is the very kind of substance that you are digging out of this now, Josh. And that's a beautiful picture to me.
Yeah.
And just that we can come in our own lives, like, there is an arc of how we regard our enemies, you know, and that is perfectly natural to want vengeance and all of that. And we see that in the Psalms, and there's a place for that. Mm-hmm. But then as we grow in the Spirit, as we grow in the compassion of Jesus, we start to think of those enemies differently. And we start to think of the way that they are overcome, not by sword, mm-hmm. but by this meal or this sacrificial meal, and even the next final step, the sacrifice of my own self for them. And that's a challenging but I think a really true thing.
Oh, we love the Psalms.
We sure do.
Well, that's all I got.
Good, because
that's all. No, that was incredible. Thank you, Josh.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many things to think about for the next week or however long you need to sit on this episode. I love it. All right, you can go to bamonastyleship.com, find the show notes there, find our contact page, find groups to get into. Like, this is a fun one. Like, we all have our assumptions about Psalm 23, our memories of Psalm 23, and hopefully now we have this new perspective on it. And maybe as we've been talking, you've come up with your own things that stuck out and make you think of something in a new way. Like, get together with somebody and talk about that, because this is fun. Like, I think we only scratched the surface, honestly.
Oh, for sure.
In this short episode.
I don't know. When Josh said the words throat slit, that made me feel like we were getting into the deep end.
But it has been good. It's great discussion. So yeah, check all that out. And thanks for joining us on the Bama Podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.